sponsored radio, KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, as well as KFCF in Fresno and online at kpfa.org. Stay tuned for Visionary Activists with Caroline Casey.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So Kabir says, friend, hope for the guest while you're alive. You think that ghosts will do it after? The idea that the soul will join with the ecstatic just because your body is rotten, that's all fantasy. What is found now is found then. So our guest did just arrive, and I'll be bringing him in a few moments. Let me weave a little bit of context first. So we live in the midst of marvels. The new year begins. And of course, there are many terrible things going on in the world, but much great energy available in the field. So right now, as the year began and ongoing right now, Jupiter in Capricorn, first time in 12 years, the story leads the way. The story attracts the molecules of its manifestation. We say some things are always true, but there are times when they're truer. We go, oh, okay, the power of story and the power of insight. And Jupiter is at a 72-degree angle to Uranus, the trickster, the maverick, the spirit of freedom and autonomy and democracy. That 72-degree angle is an angle of, it's called a quintile, division of the circle by five, harmonious eloquence and pragmatic mysticism. Uranus right now is at the particular degree is the Grail degree. The image for it right now, and therefore for the whole year in a sense, as the year began with this, is inspired art student, may it be all of us, drinking wine from an overflowing chalice, the Holy Grail, the purified heart and the life elixir it contains. A friend also at New Year's was saying, a great pagan ally down the street, she said, you know, the tradition is that scars on our bodies are places of great power, where power comes through. I'm like, what a great reframe. All right, we want to be trickster and reframe these things. And we go, and if it's not true, we're going to make it true. So next week we'll be having Neil Douglas Klotz, great Aramaic scholar. And he reminds us that the language that Jesus would have spoken, Aramaic, is this highly complex, symbolic, beautiful language, and that what comes to us, say, as blessed are the meek, in Aramaic is more like blessed are those who soften emotional rigidity within their hearts, for they shall have all the power of nature. And his latest, most mysterious offering that we're going to delve into more next week, what comes to us as love your enemies, is a much more vast instruction manual of tremendous mystery that is pertinent to our show this week as well. From a hidden place, unite with your enemies from the inside, fill the inner void. That makes them swell outwardly and fall out of rhythm. Instead of progressing step by step, they stop and start harshly out of time. Bring yourself back into rhythm within. Find the moment that mates with theirs, like two lovers creating life from the dust. Do this work in secret. This kind of love creates. It doesn't emote. So Neil Douglas Klotz will be our guest next week, and that will be fantastic. This week, it is time to lob liberating esoteric into mainstream, and we remember all esoteric teachings say, we don't need more powers, but to use the considerable ones we have already. So what a great idea it is to examine this mystery within us, the brain. So our guest, who has overcome great ardor and travails and has made it through to some miracle, and it's fantastic, is the author of Psyche's Palace, How the Brain Generates the Light of the Soul. So David Aaron Holmes, the subtext is, ablaze with the light of 100 billion sparkling neurons, the bioluminescent brain creates the sphere of the five senses and the persistent illusion of a separately existing self. So welcome, David Aaron Holmes.
Well, thank you. Hello, Caroline.
That's wonderful that you made it.
I did, by the skin of my teeth.
And how is your brain doing?
Oh, pretty good. It was a nice trickster moment there to have the transmission go a little haywire, but I'm here.
Yes. Well, you know, those are mysteries. I was also kind of, I have read deeply and skimmed some and read deeply, and I was pausing and underlining enormous amounts in your book, but also that quality of what happens when we have you take us in a guided meditation of the tropics, the hammock, the wonderful thing, the great thing. And then in a curious presaging, you say, well, what happens then if we have car trouble? And then suddenly we're anxious. And I go, oh, and that's what happened to you. As you write it, so we say, you know, so we live it. I love the phrase, you know, good mental health is just one thought away. Mm-hmm. So we go, oh, so these mysteries. So let's dive in. You certainly guide us to marvel at the extraordinary brain in self and others, which certainly guides us to informed reverence for life. I remember an Iraqi man after a bombing holding up a fragment of someone's brain and saying, this is no way to treat God's creation.
Oh, yeah.
And your book is certainly, when we go, oh, the marvels of it, the physiology and the spirit, and of course you've taken on an ambitious thing, which is to wed spirit and matter. Well, I mean, like they want to get married. Anyway, but maybe you can guide us into, I love what you said when we spoke last night, again, guiding us that the brain is, it's like the grail, okay? It's in this chalice of water. Can you guide us just into that?
Yes. I spoke with you last night, and we talked a little about mangoes, the idea of bringing something that's visible and palpable, and you can smell it and taste it. And there are some beautiful, very accessible images of the brain that really will kind of fill in this. And so, yeah, the first one is to look at the skull of the brain and its shape. It's a vault, and the brain itself is largely spherical. It has a whole bunch of convolutions, and that's for another reason, to maximize the surface area of it. But it wants to be a sphere. It's presenting the sphere of reality along its outer surfaces. And so you have this chalice, as you said, of light. That's a good image, and it's being held in the stronghold vault by the Knights Templar, and it's protected in there, and it has a life going on inside of the skull that is actually the life you're experiencing, the brilliant, colorful, melodious world that you are in is occurring inside of this ocean of crystal clear cerebral spinal fluid. So that's the first image.
And you said it's surrounded by the Pia Mater.
Right. Well, lovely name. It means the gentle mother or the faithful mother. And, you know, for the body's most critical organ, the brain, it has the strangest configuration. It's not solid and brick and mortar construction. It's this very gossamer structure that's kind of has the consistency of a soft-boiled egg, and it's surrounded by this very thin, transparent membrane called the Pia Mater, and the surfaces of this whole brain are again, what's the purpose? I'm kind of leading toward this. It's hard to know where to jump into this, but
we'll swim around in the crystal clear water.
Okay,
so, but as I mentioned to you and all guests, you know, this is a democratic show, meaning I will aspire to go and guide, you know, but you can head off any way you want to go.
Okay,
and, you know, or not, you know. Okay. But you also mentioned the Pia Mater, which is the gentle mother, it's three cells thick.
Yeah.
So it's a very, you know, and when we think of all the things we do to ourselves and people playing football, and then there's war, of course, and then there's, you know, and even the gentle, when people playfully thwack each other on the head, I really mind that, you know, going, you know, when we think of this, and as you guide us into the extraordinary complexity, but the neurons, brain floating, and so that also there's so much conversation now, I mean, maybe always, about neurons, dendrites, axons that are everywhere in our body, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
And maybe you could just define that also and put it on our brain's work table right now.
Okay.
Neurons.
Okay, good. So in the brain itself, let's talk about that. That's really where most of my theoretical thinking is happening, is in the brain. Of course, it all applies to the whole body in a way that is, you know, fantastic and magical. But there's something going on in the brain itself. And neurons have always been defined as computer circuits. I mean, we built computers, and then we thought, finally, we have a great metaphor for the brain. Well, it turns out not to be a good metaphor at all for the brain. There's a lot of computation happening. You know, there's a lot of signals going back and forth, but what are they doing? Are they just figuring out the world conceptually? I say they're not. I say what they're doing is presenting the world, that a firing of a neuron is actually the end in itself. It's a spark of light. It's a pixel. And then there's another image, like we could go right there. It's the image of the Persian carpet.
I love that image. Yeah,
that your whole cortex means bark, like the bark of a tree. And the cortex is, you know, several millimeters thick, some places more and less. But everywhere throughout the cortex, the thing that looks like a big walnut, you know, divided into two halves under the walnut shell of your skull, is everywhere the same. It's called the isocortex also, meaning it's similar all over. It has the same structure. And that structure is these little threads going through called cortical columns. And they're exactly analogous, as close as you could make it, to the threads of a Persian carpet. And some of these columns will code for the color red or the color blue or green. And some of them will work together to determine where the edge of something is. And what I'm saying is they're displaying that edge. They're displaying that color. So in the visual cortex, which is part of the neocortex, this is just a literal presentation screen, just like, you know, we don't necessarily like the analogy, but it's very clear. It's like a computer screen or like a television screen. It has these little Trinitron pixels on it. And then I
happen to have this page highly marked where you just, what you just said, but the cerebral cortex is hardly gray.
Right.
It's a much more like a delicate, shimmering, brightly colored, finely crafted silk Persian carpet that has been wadded up and stuffed into a football helmet. The cortical columns would be analogous to the individual strands of monochromatic silk yarn that pixelate to form the intricate geometric patterns that appear on the carpet surface. And then you say the cerebral cortex is a device for the production of electromagnetic qualia. I love learning a new word. What a great word, qualia.
Yeah.
Yeah, quale, the singular, and qualia. Remind us what is quale and qualia?
Okay, well, when you're dealing with a theory of consciousness, you have to account for something that is almost impossible to describe in words, and that would be called a quale, the redness of red. What does it mean? How would you talk to a blind person and describe your experience of red? You could say something analogous, like, you know, it's kind of like heat. It kind of makes me feel a certain way, but the redness itself is inexplicable. It can't be reduced to anything further. Or the brassy sound of a bugle, or purpleness of purple, or sweetness of sugar. Those are called quale, and they have to be accounted for because they're what we're experiencing. So,
What you say, qualia are ineffable. They are the internal bridge between the experience and the experiencer. That you say they put the real in reality. So, okay, is that where we get the word quality?
Yeah, it's kind of related to that term, I'm sure, etymologically. I'm positive of that, but yeah, right. It's the quality of something, right?
Yeah, what a great name you could call somebody, qualia. Anyway,
yeah.
it's just wonderful.
Yeah.
So there's the quale and the neurons in the brain. You go pixels all firing simultaneously, red, green, blue light.
Mm-hmm. Making all the other colors of the rainbow, you know, in the visual field, and then other cortical columns that look identical on the surface of the brain are doing the music. You know, they're creating harmonic structures of music that sound pleasant or unpleasant, you know, for reasons that have to do with another part of the theory. But
Well, what is that other part of the theory? Because redness, we all individually, I mean, the fiction of identity, we want to go into that, you know, the evolutionary fiction that we are separate,
right.
which I think what you're guiding us to, it's good to be able to step in and step out of that. Yeah, is that
right?
Part of your dedication?
Yes.
So the fiction of identity to, you know, and your 30 years of studying Buddhism, and then your every part of your life going brain, wonders, marvels, and also how do we inform our team so that we increase informed reverence for life?
So. Right. Well, that's what I'm all about right now, and, you know, in working with this material and writing this book, is to say I think there's a way to talk about this which will make sense to a scientist, to a neurobiologist, or a quantum physicist that's struggling with his own consciousness and the meaning of life, and allow scientists who kind of have the job of maintaining a Cartesian dualism, allow them to have a spiritual experience, you know, by looking through their own eyes at the wondrous world that they're creating with their brain, and have some sense of the actual way in which that's occurring, you know, to see it as the main function of the brain, to create the sensorium, to create what surrounds
and,
us.
And the crucial part for me is that, you know, I in last week's talk, I mentioned hearing this mean NPR show on neurons, memory, and science, and it's where they said, well, we're going to study memory by torturing these, you know, sea slugs, and they're very happy, and now we're going to electroshock them, and now we're going to tap them, then shock them, and then tap them, and then shock them, and look, all we have to do is tap them, and they go into trauma. Isn't that wonderful? This is the beginning of memory, and I'm like, oh, you bastards, God. You know, can we replace torture with wonder, you know, how about tap them and they have an orgasm, you know, chocolate, pleasure.
Right.
You know, so the whole manner of science,
right?
You know, if it's somewhere in the culture, it's everywhere. And so we go, well, we have a torturing culture and our investigation even of this sacred dedication of yours, the brain has been full of torture. Let's shock it. Let's traumatize it, and that's not, we go, that's not where memory has to begin.
Right.
So
right.
This is the antidote to that.
Yeah. Well, I say, don't get me started.
we'll get you started a little bit. You can go. I'll cut you off if you get too high dudgeon-y, you know.
No, it's not high dudgeon. It's just, you know, when you look at an animal's brain and you see that it's constructed in the same way as ours, that's why we're studying it. And we wouldn't like to be pinned down in the way that, you know, laboratory animals are.
No.
And, you know, when you begin to understand that your ego, your sense of self, has to do with a spherical presentation of a sensorium that from which you infer that you are the center of that spherical presentation, because every sphere has a center, right? So I must be the center of this sphere. What your light of your brain is really doing is creating the entire universe that surrounds you. The visual universe, the auditory universe, your somatosensory physical universe. It's creating a surround from which we are meant to infer that we are the center of it. And therefore we protect this body, and we believe ourselves to be real and identical with the body. And I say at one point that it's... you know, it's kind of weird to talk about the brain in these anthropomorphic terms. Well, actually, the brain's main function is to anthropomorphize us. It's turning us into a person. And we are light. You know, we are just cosmic light. And it's convinced us to be that we're this limited animal form.
And it's the neurons firing that create the light. Is that fair to say?
Right. Now, you know, the term light is... I use instead of electromagnetism, because electromagnetism is, you know, just what runs your vacuum cleaner and hair dryer. It's not a very romantic term. And light has all this wonderful history of spiritual, you know, work. In every tradition, they refer to consciousness as light, enlightenment.
Well, yeah.
You know, it's universal.
Enlightenment. And I did find our break music. May the long time sun shine upon you all.
Oh,
love
good.
Surround you. The pure light within you guide your way on, which we'll have as a feast. But, these marvels of light, there's something also called the pattern on the trestle board that has 10 statements that are meditations. And the most mysterious that, you know, for everybody who's learned this, is statement 8 that says, I look forward with confidence to the perfect realization of the eternal splendor of the limitless light. We don't know. We'll just go,
Well, you're participating in the limitless splendor of the eternal light right now. You are...
Yes.
You are light. You are enlightened, if you will. You know, that has a specific meaning in certain, you know, theological circles. But you are enlightening yourself, you know, by just... By realizing more and more that it actually is a play of light, the whole thing.
Well, and that's why when we were speaking last night, you know, backstage, so to speak, and I said, well, then these mysteries of the brain, light, and entheogenic sacramental plants, and you said, you know, that's not your field, and I go, oh, but it's my enthusiasm. So because part of the synchronicity of your imagery is, you know, I think what I told you last night is, what saved me from grouchy left-wing nihilism into happy, enthusiastic left-wing mysticism, was entheogenic plants. And my first vision was of Persian carpets within my brain.
Right. Wow.
So we're sort of synchronous here. And I go, ooh, beautiful arabesque complex patterns within, beautiful out. Oh, these are mysteries to be explored forever. This is all incredibly pertinent. And many people who are entheogenic enthusiasts, you know, the psilocybe mushrooms, ibogaine, the experience is of light. The interior world is illumined. And so there's something that reveals this truth, not a false, hallucination, but a absolute truth that then is like, ooh, mysteries, wonder, light.
Well, you can, there's an experiment you can do anytime, and if you're driving, please don't do this till you pull off the road. But, you know, you can close your eyes and look toward a bright light if it's a sunny day, you know, the sun, but with your eyes closed, and move your fingers back and forth in front of your eyes, and you will see patterns appearing in sparkling dots that are actually, you know, cytoarchitectural, meaning cell architecture, features of your visual cortex. In other words, when your visual cortex doesn't have anything to look at, in other words, your eyes are closed, these patterns will be there, you know, these kind of geometric patterns. And I think they have to do with, you know, their structures that focus attention toward the center. You'll see they're like a kaleidoscope. They come, you know, with a horizontal, a vertical line, and two diagonals for me. And yeah, I've asked others, and they say they see it. I don't know if they're humoring me, but, you know, they seem to be drawing your attention toward the center of focus, and maybe that's how the brain focuses your attention on the center of the visual field. So.
And then I'd also mentioned, so we have the frontal lobes where we think that we see things. And I mentioned to you last night that one of the esoteric traditions is that when they say, you know, images in our mind are comprised of molecules as much as the table in front of us, you know, a clear mental image tends to manifest. Mm. And they guide us and they say, the most effective, the portal between our illusory separated self and the world is the occipital lobe, which if we put our hands on the back of our brain, is that round curve there. And so they say a very good experiment is to, imagine transferring the interior image to the rear of our brains, and they say, well, that's where it enters the world most effectively. Do you have any thoughts or occipital images about this, or maybe just tell us about the occipital lobe?
Okay. Well, you know, it's been a recent... I've thought about this for a number of years, you know, as I've been investigating in scientific literature, the ideas that came to me really more as meditations and insights. But there's something really strange going on in the brain. Okay, let me see how to phrase this. If you look at the brain and are thinking it's creating a sphere of presentation around you, nothing's in the right place. You know that your visual world appears in front of you, and yet the visual cortex, where these screens are in the very back of your skull. What's up there? That's no good. Well, your left hand is over on the right side of your brain, and the entire left hemisphere of your brain is reporting to and controlling and also getting sensory in from the opposite side of your body. What's up with that? Well, if you put those images together and you think, what is the orientation of psyche as a person, say, as a personification? What is her orientation within your brain? Turns out she's facing backward. just like all those images of Shakti and Shiva, or, you know, they're looking at each other as they are.
And you're also reminding us that, that in the brain, in mm-hmm. each one of our brains, is the homunculus.
Right, right.
Right, which is, it's a little body.
It's a little body. It's one of...
And this is really for real, right?
This is for real.
This is great. Okay, so each one of us has a homunculus in our brain, in the center.
Right, you actually have two, which I'm thinking are actually related. One of them's called the sensory homunculus, and lying right next to it is the motor homunculus. Now, both of these, if you're looking at neurons as lighting up...
Well, and they look like little bodies?
They look like little bodies, and, you know, in a... typical neurobiology lab, you know, they're brought out and kind of scoffed at. Look at these horrible things. They got these big honking hands and, you know, a giant head. You know, they look rather odd because they're not to be looked at. You know, they're the things that we're experiencing our body with. And we'd like a lot more neurons associated with our hand because that's what we're touching things with.
And are these the drivers? I mean, are these our...
One of them is. It's the motor homunculus. So it's... It lights up as you do things. That's what I'm postulating. You know, it's lighting up as you move your arm.
But it also lights up when you... Wait, I'm sorry, but doesn't it also light up when you think of doing things?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. And so does... concentrated. You can concentrate your attention on various parts of your body, whether they're moving or not, and, you know... That will be...
Well, again, just as a little sidebar, there was an NPR story this morning about, you know, overworked hotel workers who climb steps and down and up and up, down and up, but they all said, you know, we don't get any exercise every day. And psychologists, it's an iffy story, but there's a kernel of something interesting. And they took half of them and said, well, you're actually getting more exercise than most people at expensive gyms. And the people who were told that, you know, their blood pressure went down, they lost 10 pounds, they did the thing, and it was just the thought of what they were doing. Anyway, now, back to you. Okay, back to the homunculus, yes.
Okay.
The homunculi, I guess.
Okay, well, and the feature of the homunculus I'd really like to make sure everyone knows about is there's a head of the homunculus, or rather the face of the homunculus, is separate from the rest of the body, and it actually has a different nerve, cranial nerve, that feeds it. Right, and it is performing a very important function. It's right under your temporal lobes, right under the temples on the side of your face. It's right under there. It's bolt upright. It's huge. It's much bigger than, you know, the rest of the body parts except the hands, you know. Mm. And what's it doing there? It's on the opposite side, so the right side of the face is displayed on the left side, of course, because Psyche's facing backward. That's where she needs to have that sense of a face. Well, what that homunculus is doing mainly, it's providing sensory stimulation from your face, but is that really all that important? Or is its job to make a bulwark for the sense of self? In other words, these are spatially located in the brain, and they're saying, this is where you are. You're on the inside of your face, you know, the sides of your face. So it's actually functioning to contain the sense of self within the head.
And does it look as individual as our faces?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's
we
hard to imagine.
Well,
yeah, what it looks like. It certainly feels as individual as our face feels, because its job is feeling. It's not looking. You know, I mean, it's not to be looked at.
Okay.
It's to be felt with.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's the point you also make, that, you know, for most of human history, we don't know what our faces look like.
Right.
You know, not until mirrors and I suppose water looking in, you know, and but this is so intriguing, and now it's got so much attention on it, people, you know, staring at it, and it changes the mood when you catch a glimpse of yourself in the mirror going, I look cute, I feel fantastic, oh, I look terrible.
Right.
So that's very recent in our evolution,
right,
being able to see the face.
So I think that the large area associated with the face has to do with that, so that you know what your facial expressions are looking like, because sometimes you have to hide, you know, certain emotions, or... You want to express them really well, and you have no other way of knowing if you're smiling or frowning than those sensory, you know, nerves feeding you some information. And so I think that is a very important reason why it's so large. But the fact that it's bolt upright tells me that it's also serving this function of presenting the face directly.
Well, we have much, much deep delving to do. We're going to take a very short but completely pertinent break. And for listeners, you can join us if you are inadvertently patient after break, because we do want to put a lot of material on our... we want to illumine a lot of parts of our brain. But you can call in 510-848-4425, again, if you're inadvertently patient, and we will be right back.
May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love.
And that, of course, was the Incredible String Band, and we did find it. Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and our guest today is David Aaron Holmes. And we are delving into his fantabulous contribution to our team, his book, Psyche's Palace, How the Brain Generates the Light of the Soul. Ablaze with the light of 100 billion sparkling neurons, the bioluminescent brain creates the sphere of the five senses and the persistent illusion of a separately existing self. So, yeah, so it's such a charming... It turns out that's a Quaker song that has been adopted by, you know, many people. And
oh,
may the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, pure light within you guide your way on. Well, yes, there we are. The pure light within us guide our way on. And I think it's just a great way to celebrate with you this beginning of the year, this darkest time of the year, where we're all conjuring, you know, light and fire and braziers and torches to remind ourselves of light and this constant seasonal interplay. And then, of course, as you're describing the brain to us, you know, we're kind of lighting up our circuits. So
it's always bright in there.
Well, apparently, but not unless we think about it, right?
I mean, well, yeah, you can have the seasonal affective disorder, you know, where you get kind of blue and... Yeah, you need a lot of light coming in too. You know, it's healthy.
Yeah. Now, we were talking, you know, physics and many things. Okay. So I love the astrological language as the pulsing quality of, you know, interrelatedness. That there are qualities of intelligence that reside within us and connect us to the world in very real ways. It sort of describes the field and then how we can cooperate with it. So Uranus, the trickster, is in the grail degree right now, but Neptune is straight up overhead, and Neptune's degree right now is the woman disappointed in love, remembering scenes in her boudoir.
Oh,
my
gosh.
Leads us to psyche. Isn't that
yeah,
great?
Yeah.
And we remind ourselves that the boudoir is a French term. It means a room in which to pout, like, oh, zut alors, But we say, you know, there's not a woman on the planet, indeed the planet herself, who has not been disappointed in love. And now we're back to psyche, which is, of course, Psyche's Palace is the framing myth of your book.
Right.
And if you want to, I have a lot of little notes on Neptune, because, see, Neptune, the myth, and the woman disappointed in love, Neptune is dreams, vision, water. Water reflects reverse image. So much of what you're guiding us to understand is the brain is all reversed, you know, that it is the right hemisphere that controls the left side of the body. That, I mean, they're all, that in fact you say that the image, well, say it again actually, the image-making capacity is in back of us.
Right, wait, and that includes not just the
clarify that.
Well, the occipital lobe.
The occipital, yeah.
And then there's this thing called the parietal lobe, and that is the rest of what you would maybe think of as peripheral vision. And that's where your body sense, you know, as you move your hands or think of where your body is, it's usually in your peripheral vision, and it's thoroughly enmeshed with the visual, auditory, somatosensory information, and that is parietal lobe activity. That's definitely going on in the parietal lobe. So if you look at a map of the brain, you see the occipital lobe, which is kind of the center visual field, and then right around it, surrounding it, is the parietal lobe going all the way to halfway up to the brain, and then on its edges is this body map with your face right there, bolt upright under your temples. So in other words, the whole half of the back of your brain is dedicated to presenting the front half of your experience. Now, yeah, well, that's one. I'm about ready to go on to something else, but that's one to just
I'm just doing an honorific. Mirrors, water, reversal, and then of course the left hand, right brain hemisphere. We're really also DNA serpentine, curvy spirals just in our brain body relationship. And you also go into, you know, the discovery of DNA in 1953, and let it be known that it was also by James Crick, who was tripping on LSD at the time when he saw, I mean, he writes about this frankly, he said, I'm not a mystic, these are just thinking tools, when he saw the DNA strands, the two snakes interwoven, and thought, that's the thing.
Oh, wow.
So we have this serpentine curve. Yeah, okay, so it's wherever you wanted to go. I mean, I'm happy to waft around here.
Yeah, no, I was just saying that's like amazing to me. And then there's this other amazing part, which is our frontal lobes is where all of the new development in the human takes place. It's always, you know, your forehead as you're evolving is getting straighter and straighter as brain is, you know, filling up this half. Well, the reason it's all happening there, I say, is because the other half's already taken up with presentation of the outer world. And so you have all this free real estate because it's the back half of, remember, everything's reversed, so the frontal lobes are actually experienced as being behind you, inside of you. They're your personal thinking space, right, where your dreams and images occur inside your body, inside of your brain. That means behind the homunculus face, and yet in reality they're in front of it, you know, all of that material, all of the languaging and, you know, imagination and those functions. So, in other words, the fullness of the sphere really corresponds to the fullness of your experience, both of your senses and your thinking, which in Buddhism they just consider another sense organ.
And you also say, you know, when you're talking about the Grail, you say it defends the spirit against the inner tyranny of the illusion of being separate from the animals, the other people, all these qualities. I guess I just wanted to stick that out here because it's related to the section. And when you say compassion, love, joy, and nurturing are very latecomers to the party, latecomers to evolution. Before that, it's all survival, eat it, own it, which, you know, you bring in a lot of Buddhism too, the operating from the survival chakras. And I just love, years ago, Robert Bly was talking about, you know, the poetry of the different chakras. And I said, well, what is it when somebody lives from the kind of lower chakras? And he goes, oh, that's survival. And he goes, the best example I have is, he goes, every morning I make coffee for my wife and me, and I give myself a little more because I'm going to live. You know? And I thought that was great. Yeah, because we can recognize that in ourselves. And then when we were speaking last night, also, we were talking about freedom to respond as opposed to react. And the responsibility that we all have, who have not seen someone beloved die in front of us, as so many in the world are having, where it would be very hard not to not react. Okay, the brain's like, oh! We have the freedom, the possibility, and the responsible necessity to cultivate, you know, responding so we don't react. And you were mentioning, you know, like when there's the thought to say a mean thing, you know, can you guide us, like, we inhale that back and go, no, we're choosing not to? Where's that going on in the brain?
Okay, well, you know, that's part of a section where I'm going off on the David Brasier's translation of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, which I think he's got just down perfect. And that's saying that, you know, if you look at the Four Noble Truths and you look at the etymologies of the words, you begin to see that perhaps the teaching that the Buddha was giving is not quite the orthodox view. and that he may have been talking about dukkha, which is bad things happen to you, is the first noble truth. And he lists them as individual events, not all a big glom of the world is suffering, but things happen to you specifically. And the second noble truth is the reactivity, that you will respond. You will want to get out of the situation. Your body mind will have an urge or desire. It'll be reactive. It'll be caught up. And so the third noble truth then is the practice of owning, I have had this reactivity, and releasing. So you own something and you release something. What you release is the object, the thing that you thought would bring you the happiness and the relief.
What must have that third piece of cake.
Exactly, right.
And then the fourth... or must hit this person that just hit me.
Right. Revenge.
Okay.
You know,
right.
Just very, barely getting out of your first chakra. You know, just going to, boom, you're done. You're going to do it. So you learn, you know, to take a meditative stance, and you return the thing that was the reactivity, and you release the other thing, which was the object that you wanted.
And the don't really need the cake. Don't really need to hit the person.
Right.
Okay.
Good. And then the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Path, I think, is a listing of the chakras in reverse order. In other words, grounding that energy. So right view, kind of the cosmic consciousness, right view, right thought, the third eye, right speech, the throat chakra, right action, the heart, which is associated with the hands and activity. Livelihood, the belly, you know, how you fill your belly. Right effort, with the generative centers. And then right mindfulness, meditation, the sits bones, you know, where you do your meditation. And then the eighth is right samadhi, which is the octave, right? It's everything. Your samadhi.
And you do also mention, oops.
Well, just
I'm
to
sorry,
define that term, samadhi is, you know, where your entire mind, body, everything is at one. The 18 spheres of mentation, as they call them, are brought into oneness and alignment.
So, samadhi, suspended mind, and you also mentioned in your book that the homunculus, this little human figure in our brains that actually does exist, teammates, and you said that the parts of it are large, disproportionately or proportionately to their important functions. So the sex organs of the homunculus in our brains are very large.
You know, curiously, they're large in the sensory homunculus because, you know, you feel through them, but you don't have any motor control over them, and so they don't exist on the motor control homunculus. Poor fellow.
What an interesting thought. Well, let's share some of this. Let's go to our first caller, just for the fun of it. Gus, welcome back, Gus. Our first caller, are you there?
Oh, I'm fine, and I am here, and what a delight again to hear you. I just love your show, and thank you so much for making this a profound topic. I'm one of your friendly neighborhood 3HO types. I used to sing, you know, the Long Time Sun song thousands and thousands of times. And also, although I wouldn't encourage anyone to experiment with such things as entheogens without knowing what they're doing and doing it in proper company of wise guides, etc., there is a book that I think touches on some of these things that David is discussing, a book called Mushrooms and Mankind by James Arthur. Was published.
Oh, he's our great colleague. He's our great late ancestor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you know quite well what I'm speaking of. But anyway, the thing that just amuses me no end is that he discusses, it's sort of topical in terms of the time, he discusses, for example, why reindeer really know how to fly, if you will, because they eat the red and white Amanita muscaria mushrooms at the base of all the pine trees that are soggy in the winter. And they obtain, therefore, psilocybin and experience the kinds of things that you're discussing. Anyway, my practical question for you is, what is the function of the pineal gland in the context of what you're discussing? I haven't read your book yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, that's great.
Okay, yeah. Well, you know, I kind of use, actually, you mentioned that, I sort of use it, the pineal gland as an example of a lot of theories of consciousness which think that consciousness just sort of radiates out like a sun, you know, it's just located in one little speck of brain, and that's the seat of consciousness. And I'm trying to describe that this field actually wants to expand into the whole body, expand into the whole brain. It wants to take over, you know, the whole function. And it isn't hiding away in a little corner of the brain. It isn't, I say, like a little crane operator in his cabin. You know, the light wants to fill and join and be with the rest of the body and also beyond the body. It's a, after all, this is a field that doesn't stop at your skull. This is how you can put magnets on your skull and see what's going on the inside, because it goes through your skull and it could connect in many, many ways to other beings.
So the pineal gland is, Manly Hall, all the esoteric traditions, draw these fantastic kind of
psychoactive. Sure. I have no problem with it being really, really important. I don't know anything about it. That's not...
Okay, great. Right. Well, there it is. And we can look at Manly Halls. And just as a little footnote, Gus, I had James Arthur on the air in 2003. We did a whole show on Amanita and Christmas. And then because he, alas, is an ancestor now, a great, interesting person. But we did a whole show 3 weeks ago, completely dedicated. It's in the archives at coyotenetworknews.com. You can find the entire show devoted to Christmas as an Amanita Mushroom Festival, which is completely great. And then I just remember, in my early training as an esotericist, looking at all the 19th century and early 20th century paintings of the brain, done very much in the kind of Alex Gray style, before Alex Gray was born, Manly Hall, all these esotericist mystery schools, and the pineal gland was just this humming little finger in the center of the brain that they all thought was, fantastic. But we say hi to it now. We're just waving to it.
Oh, and I'd say, it's the master gland, and, it's hugely important in the brain. But I don't know exactly what it has to do with consciousness, and kind of my construct is a little different around it. But I'd love to find out.
It's such a rich field. And, of course, as you say, that you are a great experimenter, and the whole model of... there are many ways to tell the story, thousands of stories and, metaphors that we approach reality. But all of this, and your book, Psyche's Palace, and psychespalace.com is where people can find out more, is I think a useful contribution as we start off and before we, kind of head into, politics. And it's like going brain, marvels, extraordinary power, intimacy with self, transcending the fiction of, of small identity. What a good place to begin. But let's go to our next caller, Mary in Vacaville. Come in, Mary.
I had to inadvertently learn patience when I broke my ankle recently, but it gave me a chance to be a student of patience and then to find out that I'm a humble student, and now I have to study humility at the same time. And anyway, thank you so much for bringing science and spirituality together in the same discussion, in the same book. That reminded me of when I've studied early Islam, that the scientists were considered the ones who were connecting more with spirituality and finding spirituality through the study of science. I don't know how that ever got lost. But in the meantime, too, I've been studying a new translation of an old text by Al-Ghazali, Alchemy of Happiness, which happiness
yes.
and spiritual wisdom. I'm just crazy about it. There's so many. I could just go on for years, looking around there. But the one that ties in with your discussion is, I wish I had the book in my hand here, but it was something like how to understand the senses, and the heart and the mind, and how either are the senses going to dictate the heart, and then that can get us off the spiritual track, or is the heart going to more, the senses should be more an extension of the heart's outreach, kind of, okay, you be my little guys out there, and you inform me, and I'll process, and I'll work that, and I'll send that on to the mind, and I'll bring intention to the mind, so the senses... should be a servant to the heart and mind, and that's the transforming process and how we build ourselves gradually. I think it ties, and there's actually some neuroanatomists, I think it was on KPFA, they were a guest, neuroanatomy, they are also looking into the area of connecting the senses and the mind and how, there's a lot, it's exciting to know there's a lot of people now going into the area, but I want to really look at your book because I have a lot of science people in my family, and I think this is where I think it's a very important step that you're doing with science and spirituality.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's a wonderful call, Mary, because I when I was 17, I read Al-Ghazali's The Alchemy of Happiness, and I go, I'm going to dust that off. I'm going to And as we track patterns, so here we are doing what we're doing. And then next week I have Neil Douglas Klotz, who's excavating the ancient texts in Aramaic. you're excavating the ancient Al-Ghazali. You know, we're going backwards, like the brain, to liberate, you know, like Lyra Balakwa in The Golden Compass. She goes to the underworld to liberate the dead from the Christian concept of being dead. Okay, we're going backwards as the brain would guide us. Well, I'm being a little loose here, David. I'm going to hand it back to you in a moment here. But we're going backwards to kind of excavate and liberate, and we say all metaphors of science and all metaphors of the divine want to be liberated from past confines of human imagination, you know, where they're constrained. You speak about the tyranny, you know, of parts of our kind of, I guess, reptile survivor brain that goes, no, it's just you against the world. These were needed in the early kind of prototype, but now they're impediments. As so much that is needed in our lives is good, and then it becomes an impediment. So we're going backwards textually, and we're also, you're guiding us into the brain backwards, and the brain likes to go backwards because it's set up that way. But I mean, do you think that the tyranny of a separate self was a necessary kind of prototype for initial survival, and now it's in our way?
Well, that's a little strong. I'd say it's what we've got. You know, this is how consciousness comes into being on this planet, evidently, is through individual animal forms. It may have all kinds of other ways in which it flourishes, but this is the one that we have. And there's, you know, the Buddha was very clear in his teaching. You know, he had to wrestle with this for a couple weeks after his enlightenment. Is anybody going to get this? You know, is this really going to work out? And I guess it was Brahma finally told him, you got to teach it. Some people only have a little smoke in their eyes, you know, they'll be able to see. So what he teaches is that as a human being, and, you know, not to be human-centric, but as a human being, we're equipped with everything we need to awaken. We don't need to be more evolved physically. Evolution happens because of competition and a lot of other things, you know. We have everything we need. We just have to stop, you know.
And remind us the beautiful section in your book where you talk about the Buddha and his earth gesture. And when he's delivering a particular teaching, you know, the earth spirits cry out for joy and he touches the earth. Just remind us of that thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's when he's just completely riddled with doubt, and he's sitting under the Bo tree, and just on the eve of his enlightenment, it's a make or break. He's going to sit until he either dies or gets enlightened. And he hasn't eaten. He's, you know, been doing these austerities. They describe his body, you know, like just a core, his, you know, just skin and bones.
And the sex demons are coming to titillate his homunculus.
Well, they're telling him, you know, Mara comes to him and he says, you know, all I want is your throne. You can go back to your family. You can have a wonderful life. You can be king of your kingdom over there. I'm going to offer you everything. I just want to rule you. And he brings in, you know, the dancing girls, and brings in all kinds of temptations and sloth and lethargy and, you know, avarice and all of the things that haunt our brains and our minds to pull him away. And he touched the earth, and the earth shook, and Mara vanished, because the earth was saying, you know, I got your back. I'm here. I'm supporting you. And meaning the material world is supporting the spiritual world, and your body is material, and it's supporting your spiritual essence.
And it's important that his spine is against the Bodhi tree.
Yeah, right.
You know, and what is becoming more common knowledge parlance is that, you know, the design of our neurons, okay, everywhere in our body, and firing in the brain that creates light and consciousness, are shaped like trees. There's the dendrites, you know, many, many dendrites all listening, little branches, and then one axon, and then little roots. So the tree, the back against the spine to achieve enlightenment. There's a wonderful kind of fractal repetitive image, you know, everything connected kind of quality to that.
Right.
Well, let's see if we can slip in David in San Jose. David?
Hi.
Hi, welcome.
I'm a relative relatively a newcomer to all of this. At 10 or 12 years ago, I would have dismissed you guys as kooks. I don't understand a lot of the terminology and the brain characteristics. I don't understand either, but I watched, of all things, for some reason, I watched an autopsy on YouTube, and they got to the brain, and I was just fascinated by it, and I thought, how is it that all of us, everything that we know, every moment, every sense, every smell, every joy, every memory can be in that little sphere that you're speaking of? It just opened up this whole world of possibilities, and I'm really glad that you guys are mixing science with spirituality, because even though you have to be careful in this day and age, I really appreciate your humor and your perspective on this issue, because I really want to know, but I don't know who to trust. I don't know where to go.
Right.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. That's good. Because I think part of where we're all, you know, united, you know, David Aaron Holmes, our author guest here, you know, you're talking about, you know, let us know and be informed, you know, but you speak about conducting our private brain research project, our autonomy, our direct perception, believing nothing but entertaining possibilities, our direct perception of whatever we might say of as spiritual, our direct perception, our private inquiry informed. We're allowed to do this. We have a brain. We're allowed to speculate and wonder and research and think about it. You know, and mm-hmm. this idea of freedom, you know, to wake up and explore the marvels, you know, inside and around us, going, oh my goodness, is crucial. And I just wanted to stick in one last little thing here, the freedom to respond rather than to react. And then you speak, David, you write about the opiate receptors in the brain, you know, for the endorphins, and endorphin is a short word for endogenous morphine, which is naturally produced. And our great friend Steve Behrman says, the only answer to the drug problem is improve reality. I go, yes, what a good idea. That's very simple. So the brain doesn't have no problem with, you know, endogenous morphine going, what makes us feel good? It's when we use an external powder that it actually deprives the brain. Well, I'm out of my depth here in terms of the actual physiology of what it sets up, but it robs the brain of its authentic capacity to experience ecstasy
right.
in a long-term way. Yeah.
Right. We have emotional states for reasons. They're direct communications from our body to our otherwise just floating field of spirit. You know, it needs to know, hey, there's a problem here, or you know, adjust yourself. Your butt's going to sleep or whatever. You know, you need these messages. They might be unpleasant in the moment, but they're intended to motivate you to get to a place where you're not in pain or you're not suffering. So they have your best interest at heart, your emotions.
In our dwindling minutes here all too soon, you know, Mary's great point that early Islam science, the scientists were directly connected to spirituality, that it's a kind of trick of the reality police to this false separation, spirit, matter, science, you know, mysticism, choose one, you know, to deprive us of, you know, to be ashamed of the qualities in us that are most wonderful, you know, and actually to deprive us of our capacity to be free and have a democracy and on out into there. This is a conversation that may go on forever, David, but we're on our exit. If there's a wish, if there's a sutra, if there's a phrase you want to launch us with.
May all beings be happy and free and liberated.
Absolutely.
So.
All right, maybe so. Thank you very much. Psyche's Palace, David Aaron Holmes, psychespalace.com. Thanks always to Margot Kelly in Washington, D.C., and to Gary Baca in Berkeley. Bless all your patient, great, kind hearts. And CoyoteNetworkNews.com is where you can find this archived and anything else you want, and Winter Solstice, and Amanita as a Mushroom, Christmas as an Amanita Mushroom Festival, and on and on and on. And we will reconvene next week with Neil Douglas Klotz. Thanks again, David.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm glad you made it. Oh, yeah, Dave.
Maxine Hong Kingston and 10 veterans will